Internet of Things devices aren't always made by the most trustworthy people.
And they don't care how secure they are. They meet the minimum security standards. Probably if they are using SSL, it's TLS 0, which my 15-year-old nephew can hack these days. So, I mean, it's very insecure.
Welcome to You, Me, and IBMI.
Hey, Kurt, welcome to the latest episode of You, Me, and IBMI podcast. We've got with us today Jerry McKee. He's actually a teammate of mine. I've been working with him for a lot of years, so I already know the guy pretty darn well. So I think you're going to have to be asking most of the questions today. But
Well, the first question would be, what's it like working with Alex?
Oh, it's great. Alex is a good guy. Yeah.
Okay, no, Alex is going to leave the room now, and then you can tell me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. No, like Alex said, we've worked together probably for 20 years. I bet we've known each other here at IBM. Maybe even longer than that.
It's been a while. Yeah. Been a long time, Jerry.
That's right.
Well, anyway, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You and I were both kind of like jacks of all trades, master of none. You've got a special skill in securing connectivity to and from the IBMI. So we're gonna talk a little about that today.
Sure.
But Kurt, you had a really interesting case. I think it was last week that I thought it might have a bearing on this secure communication conversation we're going to have today.
I did.
Can you tell us about it?
Well, I've had two cases in the last 2 weeks that were really interesting, and they kind of highlight the idea that the product that we support is very reliable. And, you know, we really care about our customers, you know. And in both of these cases, the customers have been IBMI, you know, when they started AS400 users for a very long time. And the issues are very different. The one customer that I helped has been using the same process for printing for a long time, and eventually her printer died. It's a line printer, and so she's dealing with older programs written in COBOL, RPG, that she's not really able to update on her own, and that's hooked into a line printer for output that makes it hard to work around sending that data to a laser printer if you don't have good access to the application. You know, mm-hmm. But she's been with the AS400 since her dad bought it when it started. And the other guy is actually maybe even more interesting. He was still running V4R4. And today we're talking about networking, we're talking about SSL. And this guy's system has never been on the internet. It's never been part of a network. Everything has always been TwinX attached. And finally, one of his display consoles finally got so faded that when he switched in another one, a 3477 info window, the printer configuration didn't work anymore. And luckily I remembered how to work with TwinX, print device address, and we got him up and going again. But his father had bought the system back in 1999, and they'd never put on a PTF. They'd never had any service with it done, except for a couple times when they'd had hardware issues and it was mirrored, so they would just, you know, switch and then fix it and switch back. But two situations very fraught, and one of the reasons for that may be in the quality and the longevity of the system makes it easy to go without updating it for say 26 years and never need to update it. But today we're talking about something very different, which is people needing to constantly update their stuff when they use SSL.
Correct, yes.
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, security in my mind is always a balance between access and security, which is kind of self-referential. But, you know, in the case of your TwinX customer, they had the access that they needed, right? And they had physical security, right? They weren't connected to the internet. They weren't connected to any PCs. I don't think there are any PCs that can make a connection via TwinX these days. Yeah.
So they've never used client access. It was only dumb terminals.
Yeah. So, you know, the need for security on the system really came to be when we started allowing more greater access. Yeah. Access to PC networks, mm-hmm. access to the internet, access to God knows what else, right?
Right.
But yeah, I guess if you're still back in TwinX days and you know in that situation, you can utilize physical security.
Yeah, it does speak to the quality of our hardware back in the day, and if you're in an isolated environment like that, I think that's a good thing. But in today's, you know. We're doing a lot of work across the internet now, a lot of online banking, so there's a lot of predators out there, so you do have to worry about security. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, and not only do you have to worry about security, but you can't say, okay, I set up my security, and now I'm done.
Right.
Right? It's constantly evolving. The threat landscape is constantly evolving, so you've always got to be considering that. You've always got to be updating certificates. You've got to be, you know, making sure you don't have any expired certificates and whatnot. Really quite a bit more of a challenge to keep your system secure these days than back in the TwinX days.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even from 7.1 to 7.5, there's been huge changes in encryption. Protocols have been updated. In fact, 7.1 you can't even use in a PCI-compliant area or arena, because it doesn't support anything beyond TLS 1.0.
What do you mean by a PCL compliant, or PCI?
PCI compliant?
Yeah.
A PCI is a standard that is used in industry. So if you deal with banking, online credit cards and such,
sure,
things of that nature, companies have to be compliant with that. They get audited. And if they don't meet that compliancy, there are consequences.
Okay. I've seen PCI compliant before, but I guess I always assumed it was dealing with PCI computing.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not like PCI buses.
Okay.
PCI.
Okay.
PCI compliancy is a federal regulated standard.
Hey, while we're doing acronyms, you mentioned TLS.
Yes.
But then there's SSL. So what's the deal with those? Like.
Well, SSL is secure socket layer. TLS is transport layer security. They are essentially one and the same. It's just that one's more updated than the other. So industry always refers to a secure data stream as SSL because that's just a facto standard. TLS is just a newer standard that's out now, and that's what's used, you know, out in the wild. So you're going to see the two main protocols currently are TLS 1.2 and TLS 1.3. In a perfect world, everyone would be on TLS 1.3. But
so we're using TLS, mm-hmm. but it's okay to call it SSL. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, industry-wide, everybody calls it SSL, Secure Socket Layer.
Okay.
It's kind of like everybody calls an adjustable wrench a crescent wrench. Well, crescent is a brand. It's not the type of wrench.
Right, right.
You know, it's same concept with SSL and TLS, right? So
I guess Germans call crescent wrenches Engländers.
Yeah.
Because Germans would have the appropriate size, and then they would look down on the guy who just uses a crescent
just
wrench
uses
for every
a crescent
size,
wrench
and
for
that
everything.
Guy's probably English, so they call it an Englander.
Yeah, but so you can equate SSL to TLS. They're two separate things, but everybody calls it SSL these days.
It's kind of like how TCP IP is made up of two things.
Right.
Is that?
Right, right. TCP and then you have IP.
Okay.
Right. Correct. Yep.
So, Jerry, usually with these podcasts, they're a little bit technical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you don't want to rely on a podcast for all your technical information about the system, right?
Absolutely not.
So we always have like links at the bottom of the podcast that listeners can refer to get more information.
Sure.
Here's kind of maybe a tough question for you, but let's say I'm an IBM I administrator and we've been running, you know, unsecured for the last 10 years, and my boss comes to me and says, "Hey, Alex, you've got to implement SSL. where do I start? What are some good resources? And, you know, if there's a bunch of links, you know,
sure,
we'll post them at the bottom of the podcast.
Well, and just to jump in, how would someone who's not running secured know if they're running secured or not? Like, what's something a customer can do who's running right now? What's something they can do right now to see, hey, am I doing the right thing with my system?
Well, so first of all, you have to understand your applications. If it's a web-based application and it's secured, it's going to be HTTPS. So you're going to see that it's secured in your web browser, right? Everybody's seen that works. You don't even have to be technical. You see the little lock symbol in your browser, stuff like that. So that's one easy way you can tell if your application is secured or not. If you're using an application that's like JDBC or a C++ application or a Java application, something like that, it's a little trickier to know if it's secured or not. That's where your developers have to understand what they're doing. You can check for listening ports in netstat. Generally speaking, the IBM i has specific ports that are called listeners on the IBM i when you connect to them, like your host servers.
Sure.
Your telnet, you know, all of that. So like telnet, your connections for SSL will come in on port 992.
Okay.
Your host servers, they're generally going to be non-SSL would be 8470 through 8476.
Okay.
SSL ports are going to be 9470 through 9476. Your DDM DRDA connections, non-SSL be 446, SSL 448.
Okay.
So you can tell by looking in netstat and looking at your ports, and you can see which ports are SSL, which ports are not. Generally, it'll be a little suffix or prefix at the end of the job names.
Okay.
They'll give you a hint if they're SSL related or not. For instance, database, host server database jobs.
Yeah.
You know, if you got a job QZDA init, well, that's not SSL. QZDA SSONET, it's going to be SSL. That's going to be an SSL-based job. You'll have similar things with your host servers and stuff. The job names will be a little different.
Okay.
Some of them may indicate SSL with a dash S at the end. So it just depends. You have to do your research and figure that out. If you don't know, that's where you call us. We'll tell you.
That's a good answer.
That's why you pay for support. You get it from us.
That's right.
And how did you get into SSL? Why do you know so much about SSL, Jerry?
Well, back when I worked on another team, it was the team that supports our old Access client, not even Access client solutions, it was Access for Windows. Back in the day when I worked on that team, SSL wasn't very prominent. It wasn't really used at all. It was very rare to see someone using SSL. Let's put it that way. This is back in the early 90s. There was no hackers back then, right? That we were aware of.
Right.
Anyway, so as time went on, a guy named Marty Smith gave us a class in SSL, and it just piqued my interest.
Okay.
And that's how I got spurred on to SSL. Now, my team, mine and Alex's team, we don't directly support SSL. There's a whole nother team that supports that. But I just got into it really deep, and it just interests me because it applies to everything. And in fact, you know, going on into the future, you're going to have to use SSL. I mean, you're not going to have a choice.
Or go back to TwinX.
Or go back to TwinX, yeah. Go back to an island system, you know, and just use TwinX and have 20 people access your system, and then you're paying, you know, $100,000 for a fancy printer.
Yeah. That is true. What's interesting, because you said, how do you know so much about SSL when you guys aren't really on the team that supports that? But there is that thing, that concept of, you know, it's a gray area of what we all support.
Yeah.
Because whereas I'm in Save Restore BRMS, if someone wants to, say, slip lick on the system, well, technically that's internals. Or if we are in print and there's a communications issue, well, technically, you know, maybe we should involve the comm team for that. But when these things overlap, it's so good to have that extra knowledge be able to get the answers to the customer quicker, and then just understand the whole thing more holistically about how is, you know, with data access, how is that working with
sure
security, and I'm sure that has implications for performance and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, my knowledge is, you know, I'm kind of a jack of all trades. I started in hardware support. So I was supporting TwinX back in the day.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
When did you start?
So I started back in the very early 90s. I actually started in manufacturing.
Okay.
And then I went to hardware support, then into software support. So I've kind of been around the block a couple times in IBM. So I've got a lot of overall knowledge. Yeah, SSL just, it's one of those things, I don't, everybody's got it. Like, Kurt, for you, it's printers. You like the hell out of printers. You're an expert in printers.
I don't know what it is. I just like them.
If I have a printer question, I know to come to Kurt, right?
Sure.
And Alex, you're into, you know, all kinds of stuff. You know, there's like JDBC and stuff and that kind of stuff. You know that like the back of your hand. So I got questions. I come to Alex for certain things. You know, you learn working in the center who has a knack for what. Mm-hmm. And you learn which people to go to.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so I guess SSL just piqued my interest. Another thing that piques my interest is communications in general.
Sure.
I don't know why. It just trips my trigger. So it's just something that piques my interest. So.
Yeah. Well, we all have those things.
Yeah.
You know, I know that for networking, I know that I've never understood really about how to break up networks.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a network, then it's like there's like a colon and a 24 after it. And somehow if you configure it a certain way, then you can. And yeah. I don't understand how that works, but it is kind of fascinating.
Right.
And so, yeah, reading communications traces. I just, you know, I like that stuff.
Yeah.
Alex, what's your favorite kind of call to get?
Oh, I like looking at traces. You know, we've got some really nice trace parsing tools, and it's fun to be able to just take that, you know, a 500 megabyte file or a gigabyte file, and find the relevant piece of information. You know, searching for a needle in a haystack sometimes, but it's fun. It's rewarding when you finally find it and can deliver an answer to the customer.
Yeah,
and I can just imagine they're like, how the heck did you find that in that trace?
Yeah, if I have a really complicated trace, I'd go to Alex. Alex likes to dig. He'll dig until he gets the answer.
Yeah. When I started, there was a guy on print named Roger Tangen, mm-hmm. and he was telling me about one time somebody delivered a trace to him
mm-hmm.
on a pallet. They actually called him from shipping and said that they had printed out this trace. It was on a pallet, and would he come down to get it? And I immediately had the idea, like, why would you do that? Like, so I asked him, what did you do? And he was just really nonchalant. He's like, oh, it's a hardware trace. I found it on page 100 something. But he just went down there, sat down, started reading it.
Wow.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Marty Smith earlier, my first recollection with Comtrace is actually reading snippets of communications traces that had been faxed in. And Marty would always help me with that.
Yeah.
Before the days of customers being able to send in, you know, digital trace files and being able to apply our trace parsing tools to those.
Well, and using Wireshark, for some things it's good, but for other things, I just want to see the text. I want to be able to go through circle stuff. I'm like, you know, it feels better sometimes to just have the real trace sitting in front of you.
Yeah, we have an internal tool called CTT that we use. But we can't put that out to customers. But the nice thing about SSL is you can use Wireshark to figure that out.
Sure.
Wireshark is, in my opinion, the best tool to use for figuring out SSL issues. Now, the newer SSL protocols, or TLS, I should use the correct term here, TLS, you know, 1.3, that's a higher security level, and it's very hard to get anything out of external traces.
Can you see the handshake part of it?
You can see the handshake. You can see some of the error codes, but you can't get as much information as you can, let's say, out of TLS 1.2. TLS 1.2, I can actually take a Wireshark trace and extract the certificates out of it. Okay. TLS 1.3, you can't do that.
Oh, okay.
So they don't show up in plain text.
I didn't know that. Okay.
So it's a very secure mechanism, TLS 1.3. Now, I don't know. I can't predict the future, but I imagine as AI and quantum start merging together, it's going to be harder and harder to secure our data. And in fact, that's nothing new. I'm not discovering this. You can read this. It's widely published that it is going to be a problem in the future. So I don't know what in the future, what's going to become of TLS, if there's going to be a new protocol that's going to come out to replace that even. But
something quantum safe is the term, right?
Quantum safe, yeah.
Maybe like quantum twin X?
Maybe QTLS. QTLS, or quantum twin X. There you go. There you go, quantum twin X, yep. Wireless twin X.
So Jerry, 7.6 came out pretty recently, new to 7.6 is multi-factor authentication.
Yeah.
Do you know if there have been any, like, big changes for SSL?
Not in addition to what's already out there for 7.5 as far as the protocol itself goes and ciphers. I'm not aware of anything. But our developers are always enhancing Digital Certificate Manager and adding features. So it's getting to be easier to manage certificates in TLS. In fact, I've heard through the grapevine a lot of that's going to be eventually moved into Navigator for I.
Okay.
But I can't share any more than that because it's unannounced stuff. But
no, sure.
I feel that's going to be a thing in the future.
That actually brings me to a question that recently I did a video with Ted Dow. Actually, he helped me kind of lay out this video.
Yes.
About using certificates and exporting and importing certificates between systems.
Yeah.
And that's a concern. When you're using certificates, you can't just create them once, set them up, and they'll work forever, right? They expire.
Mm-hmm.
And so one question that I would have as a customer is there an easy way to maintain and keep track of what my certificates are, when they're expiring, when I need to be recreating them so that I'm not impacting my applications?
There's not an easy answer to that. The short answer is no, we don't provide a mechanism that's going to alert you automatically or do anything. Could you set up stuff to do this? Yes. If I was a customer out there in the wild.
Yeah, how would you do it?
I guess I would use tooling like Ansible. And that's an automation tooling. And I would use Ansible to make queries on a regular basis and generate reports. That's what I would do if I was a customer.
Alex, you're a big Ansible guy.
I do work with it a little bit, not any more than Jerry does.
No.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. So Ansible is it's an industry standard tool. I mean, it's not new. People have been using it for a long time. I know IBM started adopting it. Oh, how long has it been, Alex? About 5-6 years now?
Around there, yeah.
Somewhere in there, we started getting big into it.
Does it run on the IBM I, like, in Q-shell, or Ansible, where does it live?
Ansible can run anywhere, really. You can run Ansible on a Raspberry Pi.
Oh, so you run it against the system.
Yeah.
You don't run it on the system itself.
So you have a server-client situation, okay, right? Okay. So your Ansible can run on a Linux-based system outside of the I, and then it can manage, 500 IBM I systems. It can deploy PTFs to all of those systems, right? Or you can host Ansible on a singular IBM I and send out updates to 500 other IBM I systems and a Linux box out there. So Ansible, you can run anywhere, basically.
Okay.
There's other products that Red Hat sells, like Ansible Tower, which is a web-based GUI for setting up your what's called a playbook.
Okay.
Playbook is written in a language called YAML.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that before, yeah.
So I won't dive too much deeper into that. I'm just putting some ideas out there for people. But yeah, Ansible is how I think I would manage systems. If I had a lot of systems, if I just had one or two systems to manage, it's not worth the extra effort, sure, in my opinion, to set up Ansible and do all of that. But if you're an admin of hundreds of systems, Ansible is the way to go. You want to use that,
okay,
in my opinion. But yeah, now I do know in Digital Certificate Manager, when you view your certificates, when they're starting to get close to expiring, they now have colors. So you'll see a yellow color on a certificate that's close to expiring. And then expired ones will be like a pinkish red color, for instance.
But you got to be looking at it.
But you got to be looking at it.
Give me a message.
And, you know, unfortunately, colors don't help the people who have eye issues.
Sure.
Colorblind people. Colorblind people out there, that color's not going to help.
And there are blind people out there.
Help them, and that's not going to help a blind person either, unless somebody's added the correct tags to it.
Which they should be doing. That's
right. Which they should be doing. It says this color is red.
Yeah.
You know, or something like that. Yeah. And that's an industry standard, which we should be doing if we're not already. I don't know if we are or aren't. And that's a whole nother topic. But yeah, so, you know, automation tooling is something that we do not provide by default. It's free to set up, but, you know, at its raw source for Ansible.
Sure.
It costs knowledge. You know, so if you don't know how to do it, it's a learning curve.
It's a good time. Yeah.
Right.
But that's time well spent.
Exactly.
If you have a lot of systems to manage.
But that's how I would do it.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool.
I would just mention, because like I'm a little bit allergic to graphical user interfaces.
Yeah.
I'm not colorblind, but I might as well be.
Yeah.
There is that DCM print system store coming out from QMG Tools, which I've used with some customers because, you know, if you want to know their certificate environment, you can just have them run that, and it'll generate a list of all their certificates. So I find it really handy. To do that, you know, in a situation where you're working with one system, obviously, like you said, if you've got, you know, many dozens of systems, you want some automation in there, but yeah, I really like that print system store command that's part of QMG Tools.
Yeah, I know our developers, Adler and Grzynski, have created stuff on their GitHub sites as well for managing certificates.
Oh, that's good. We'll find that link to that. That'd
so
be cool.
We should find that link and provide it to
us
for this podcast. It's kind of cool. I don't know how useful they'll be. They must be somewhat useful if they created them.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
you know, we talked a little bit earlier about how you got started. How did you get, so you started working at IBM in manufacturing, you said, how did you get interested in computers in general? We've talked about that with people before.
Yeah, so.
Because you play video games.
I am somewhat of a gamer. I wouldn't say that I'm a huge gamer anymore. I'm getting a little old to be doing that all the time. But I got started, actually. Our old neighbor when I was a kid, like real young, was into ham radios.
Oh.
And he had one of those old phosphor screen oscilloscopes. And he was always tweaking his antenna and stuff and looking on that oscilloscope. And, you know, he was an old ex-military guy that, you know, had a lot of tubes, right? He used tubes, not transistors.
Wow.
So, and that really piqued my interest as a kid. I thought it was just cool, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what sent me down my path. And then eventually, as I went through high school, I went to college for electronic engineering technology.
Okay.
And so my background's actually electronics. And I started with IBM in the card area, actually.
Okay.
And I was just doing screen printing and stuff like that, solder paste, and running cards down machines that would auto-populate the cards.
What kind of cards, Jerry? I mean, these aren't punch cards, right?
No, these weren't punch cards. No. These were
Twin X cards? No.
They actually were.
Okay.
We actually built Twin X cards on that line. Wow. So I'm very familiar with those. We did pin through hole, and then we also did, discrete components. I won't get into it too deep, but And then I went into testing where people would bring me the card that failed in test, and I had to debug it down to a failing component.
Oh, that's awesome.
Can I ask you a soldering question, Jerry?
Sure.
Because yes, I've got some home projects sometimes, and I'll be huddled over an Arduino or something like that and soldering the pins on.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's always these fumes, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, am I breathing in lead? Because I know this solder has lead in it.
Well, I mean, it depends. There's lead-free solder, and then you have the leaded solder, 60-40.
Yeah.
Lead solder.
I'm pretty sure I'm using the leaded stuff because it just works
easier. The leaded stuff is the easiest to work with, and that's what I use, too. Should you breathe the fumes? No.
Oh, really?
it's a carcinogen and will kill you.
Okay. Oh, great. I didn't know that.
So it's carcinogenic.
It smells really nice, I think, but you shouldn't breathe it. No. It
smells good while it's killing you?
As long as you're not doing it every day, it's not going to kill you. But it's not going to help you either.
Okay.
You should use a fan and at least at minimum blow it away from your face.
Okay.
Or
there you go. Keep the fan behind you.
You know.
I've got all my soldering equipment in the garage, right? I used to have it in the basement, and I do it down there. Yeah. But there's no airflow down there, so yeah. I'll do it in the garage.
I actually grabbed an old computer fan. It's about an 8x8 fan, and I bought some generic carbon filters for it. And I put something together. So I have that sucks it away from my face.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Because I'm always soldering all the time. I tinker a lot.
Really?
So I use like Arduinos, Raspberry Pis, STM microchips, like just for an instance. I made my own digital to analog converter. So
what do you use that for?
It's interesting you ask me that. It's kind of a long story. I'll try to shorten it up a little bit. So my dad gave me these two DVD towers, and they store like 80 DVDs in them. Yeah. And there's a buttons on top that you press like 01, 57, hit enter, and it opens them up. So they're storage towers, and they have software. It comes, or you can label it, and you pick the DVD you want and hit a button on your computer, and it opens the door up, right?
Yeah.
So I have a little nostalgia for jukeboxes. So I'm taking one of these DVD towers, and I'm gonna 3D print my own robotic arm that grabs the DVD out of it and puts it in a player and plays the music you want.
Cool.
I know I could take a little chip that's literally an inch by an inch on the board, and I could make an MP3 player with it and play the music, right?
Yeah, sure.
I know I could do that. I'm nostalgic, so I want to make something that's kind of a Frankenstein that does this.
Yeah.
Well, in that, I actually looked at it, and I found they're using an old microprocessor, and they're using an analog-to-digital converter. So I need to make an analog signal based on a number that you put in through a serial input. And this digital-to-analog converter creates voltages at different levels that microprocessor reads and interprets as the bay number. So that's why I created my own.
Yeah.
Now, I could have bought a digital to analog converter that's prepackaged. I'm fully aware of that.
Sure.
But for a learning exercise, I made my own.
Sure.
So that's what I do for fun.
That's awesome.
And people like been dumpster diving around the site here.
Yep.
And they have found oscilloscopes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I got a little bit fancier one at home. I actually bought one, so I have a fancier one.
Okay, nice.
It'll actually take serial signals and interpret the data in them automatically for
really?
You.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I like all that kind of stuff. That's what I do for a hobby at home.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a man of many talents, Jerry.
Yeah, I enjoy learning, I guess. I don't want to let my brain just die. I'll probably never retire. I don't want to. I like learning. I like just doing stuff.
Yeah, plenty of stuff to learn here in IBM support.
Yes. And as long as you're not breathing in lead solder, you'll be able to do that for a long time.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So Jerry, when I play around with SSL on an IBM i system, I'm usually using self-signed certificates because it just seems like simpler to me. I don't have to purchase a license to use any of the well-known certificates, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that going to continue to be a thing long-term or not?
Self-signed certificates are good for on-prem applications. They are going to become a thing of the past, though, I think, in the future. They're just what it says. You're signing your own certificate saying, this is a good certificate because I say so. So you're basically printing your own passport at home and pawning that off as, this is me, trust me. The problem with self-signed certificates, there's a lot of bad players out there that would take advantage of that or could take advantage of that.
How would they do that?
Well, you've heard of man-in-the-middle attacks and stuff like that. So they can, if they got physical network access somehow, normally through an Internet of Things device and backdoor you that way.
Sure.
And that brings me to another interesting topic. Please keep your Internet of Things devices on a private network separate from your normal network. Do not put them on the same network if you use them.
What are some examples of Internet of Things devices that people might not think about?
Smart light bulbs, thermostats.
On their own network.
On your own network, yeah. Or even in companies.
You mean like away from the IBM i, too?
Yeah, away from the IBM. Keep them off the IBM i network if you're using them in your office for smart light bulbs, smart thermostats.
I would never think about that.
Anything like that. Don't put them on the same network. Put them on a separate network. Even your mobile devices, keep them on a separate network than from your home laptop where you're conducting business on. Don't put them on the same network.
Internet of Things devices aren't always made by the most trustworthy people,
and they don't care how secure they are. They meet the minimum security standards. Probably if they are using SSL, it's TLS 0, which my 15-year-old nephew can hack these days. So, I mean, it's very insecure. I mean, there's scripts out there people can just get. They don't even have to know anything.
Yeah.
Run a script, and they're in your network now.
So somebody could take a smart light bulb that they buy at Menards.
Yeah.
It was made for $10.
Yeah.
Screw it into a network.
Yep.
That is somehow connected to their IBM i system.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, their IBM i could be at risk of being
compromised.
Hacked.
It's compromised. Correct.
I would not ever think of that.
It's smart. That is the one of the biggest security risks you can do is Internet of Things. I love them and hate them at the same time. That's why I developed my own at home.
Well, there you go.
I don't use prepaid for ones. I know it's more cost effective. I know it's easier. I mean, who doesn't like easy? If you do use them, keep them on a separate network. Keep them on the guest network of your router.
Okay.
You know, Jerry, I've got some smart light bulbs at home, and I've never connected them to the network yet because I was like, I'm not sure what the security exposure is there. So that's interesting.
How do you use them?
I don't. They're sitting in a box. I'm waiting to figure out how to use them.
So all of them, you have to download some app on your phone, and then you have to give them permission to access your network. You connect to them what's called AHOC, or ad hoc connection to them. It's a point-to-point wireless connection. And then you give them your SSID and your password for your network. Do you trust that person? You know, how much trust do you have? Do you trust an item that's made by somebody you don't know who?
Right. The lowest bidder.
The lowest bidder using the lowest security they can do to get away with it. So place your Internet of Things on your guest network along with your phone that has that application for the Internet of Thing. Because as soon as you install a trusted application on your phone, guess what? They're on your network too.
Right.
So that's something to keep that is very
great
aware
advice.
Of.
Yeah. I love that this conversation took that turn because that's something that helps you at work and at home.
Yeah. So that's my biggest advice I can give anybody is keep your Internet of Things on a guest network separate from your home. If your phone has an app for those, keep your phone on that same guest network. Keep it off of your other network for your business.
And just to go back to the self-signed certificate, I just want to mention, like, a lot of times I'll be accessing an IBMI website, and it'll be using a self-signed certificate, and so the web browser client always prompts me, "Are you sure you trust this certificate?" So I gotta go in there and say yes, go ahead and trust it, and then I can actually make my connection.
Right. So a lot of your lab systems that we have here specifically have self-signed certificates, which is fine. I mean, they're isolated. They're not accessing out on a public website or something. And what you're talking about, we call pink eye, because it's a little pink warning with a pink cross. So we call that pink eye.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay. I've never heard that before.
Yeah,
that's funny.
So we say a self-signed certificate will give you pink eye, right? So that's what we say. And, you should, if you're using an application that's touching the internet, don't use self-signed certificates. In fact, a lot of companies won't allow you to anyway. You're going to have to create what's called a certificate signing request, send it off to a company like GeoTrust. I don't know if VeriSign's even around anymore.
Thought.
You know, some other third-party company has signed that, and then they'll sign it and send it back. And then typically you'll have a chain certificate. Then you can generally go to that same company and download their intermediate and their root certificate from their website at that point. A lot of applications will, for the public side of things, will pre-populate with known trusted.
Like web browsers do that.
Like
so
web browser.
Always
that,
asking
that's
you,
why
you
your web
this?
Browser just magically works, right? Because it goes out and downloads all those public certificates for you behind the scenes. Our client, not so much. So you still may have to go out and manually
do some manual steps.
Okay.
So. But,
and like, if I'm a security administrator, I mean, I don't know if you have an answer to this question, but does it cost a lot of money to work with these third-party security secure certificate signers?
I don't know how they're billing any at this time. It used to be...
It's all advertising.
it used to be a one-time fee for a company, and it's based on a number of employees that you have.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's a one-time fee, but
now,
but it also expires, so you have to get another one anyway.
It also expires, but now I imagine the way companies like to do things is you buy terms, right? So you buy like a year term with whoever, that's just the way of the future. That's what companies are doing now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I prefer the day when you bought your software and it's yours forever.
The TwinX is yours to use.
Yeah, I like
for 26 years.
That's right. And to kind of follow up on what you were saying about this lady and her TwinX, when I worked in hardware support, there was a customer that was on TwinX, and their system had been running for 15 plus years, just perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had a flood, and their system went underwater, and they couldn't find their system. They didn't know where the system even was located.
In the building.
In the building. They didn't know where it was. Well, it turns out it was in a closet, and someone walled it in with sheetrock.
Oh my God.
They had to physically bust through the sheetrock to get to the system. That's how reliable that system was.
Wow.
That's awesome. It was actually walled.
That's
a true story.
Yeah. I totally believe that. Yeah.
That's how reliable that system was. The only thing that took it out was Mother Nature during a flood.
Wow.
Everything is susceptible to something.
That's right. That's right.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us here today in our little room that we record this in. I know it's great to get you in here and have a lot of, you obviously have a lot of interest, kind of an excitement in this area.
Yeah.
And it's an area where, even though it's an older technology, I mean, SSL's been around for a while.
Yeah.
Customers need to keep up on it in order to secure the systems daily.
Right. And, You have to keep your systems up to date to keep up with the protocols, to keep up with the cipher specs, keep your PTFs up to date.
Is there a good Is there a group? Sorry, Alex. Is there a group PTF for that? That
there is a security group.
Oh, just a security group. Okay.
There's a security group, and then obviously, if you're using HTTP servers, it's a HTTP group, and then the Java group goes hand in hand with the HTTP group. So, so you know, just keep up to date on your PTFs. Don't let them fall behind.
On both the client and the server, right? That's
correct.
Because they're
that's correct.
If they're not running the same protocol versions, it's not going to work. making a handshake. Yeah,
that's right.
Well, Jerry, thanks for joining us on You,
Me,
and IBM I.